Hi, I'm John.
I'm Genevieve.
And I'm Caleb.
And this week, we've watched Friday's Child. And now we're going to argue about whether it's going to make us quit Star Trek. So, yeah, Olivia's not here. So no one's having a breakdown at this point. She's busy in the real world, which honestly we like to consider a good thing on this podcast. So instead...
How dare she?
So I brought the third host of the podcast.
Hello. Luckily, I don't have a life, so it's fine. I can come on anytime.
And we're very grateful to her so that we can have uninterrupted, terrible Star Trek. And, well, actually, you know what? Fuck that. This is a good episode. Fuck this.
Olivia, I would not call this a terrible episode.
Yeah. Olivia is not here to stop me. This is a good episode. Thank you, Kayla.
You're welcome.
This is a good episode. There were hijinks. There were Klingons. Scotty was fun. Scotty was very fun. A woman got slapped. That wasn't fun. We don't approve of that at all. But they blew up a hill as well. That was fun.
And McCoy has a weird thing with touching people. I don't know.
He's also got a baby now.
That's true.
I will say this is a bit of a spoiler for the end of the episode, but they named the baby Leonard, and I was like, oh, they named it after Spock actor Leonard Nimoy. It's named after Spock and Bones. And I was like, it was named after Spock and Kirk, and I'm like, that was sweet of McCoy to name a child after them.
10 minutes later. Wait.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a fun episode. I mean, Olivia isn't here to stop me enjoying it either.
I'll let you enjoy whatever you want, Jack, truly.
Is this because I have to pay you $20 per episode now?
Oh, I actually forgotten. Thank you for reminding me. Just to clarify, Caleb, you correct me if I'm wrong, you identify as a man?
That is correct.
Okay, so I actually have a contract with Jack that if I appear on any podcast as the only woman, he has to pay me $20 per man or $50, whichever is more. So that'll be $50 for this episode.
Oh, nice. That's a pretty sweet deal. Lucrative.
Yeah, not for me. Thank I have fuck all money right now.
He's $130 in the hole, truth be told.
I paid you $80.
That's true. You have paid me, but he's owed me a total of $130. All of your merchandise sales are going to my fees.
They already went to charity.
Ask for money, ladies.
So, Caleb, while I think about where the fuck I'm going to find some money, when was the first time you watched Star Trek? Where did you start?
So I started in elementary school. I was actually homeschooled until fourth grade. And so not having any friends until after 4 o'clock when all my public school friends got home, I would just watch the original series reruns on the Sci-Fi Channel. So actually original series was my first show. And then I didn't get back into the other shows until I was in college when everything went on Netflix. It was just TOS for a while and then nothing for a long, long time. And the Kelvin movies came back and then found my way. And now I've seen everything.
Excellent. And was there a quitting moment? Do you remember as a kid sitting at like 3:30 in the afternoon and going, I can't do this?
Oh, it was probably a season 3 episode of the original series. Seasons 1 and 2, you know, not bad. Good stuff. Probably somewhere in season 3, I was like, ugh, so bored of this.
Season 3 is... We've had, season 3, you know, it's Spock's brain. And it's sort of go from there.
I will say that, so I watched the original series mostly. My uncle had the collector's edition DVDs that came in the little cases. And so we would borrow them from him. And I watched the third season, like, I think when I was at his house or at some sort of family event. But the first and the second seasons I had for a long time. So I've definitely seen those episodes more. And I will say part of that is people were like, oh, season 3 is just bad. But I feel like there are some really good episodes of that I didn't see for a long time because everyone said that.
There definitely are. I mean, Tholey and Webb is like the big one, but I think Mark of Gideon is in that season, and that's like a good episode up until the very end.
It's like Mark a decent of Gideon episode. A good episode? That's the overpopulation like one, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's like, but the first half, it's like this mystery where he's the only one on the Enterprise. And I'm just like, this is cool. It kind of reminds me of his own like little menagerie. And then it just goes and spirals out real quick.
I just think that happens on a lot of Star Trek episodes where there's like so many times they come up with a really good premise. Like the setup is really good. And like, they don't quite have a payoff that justifies it, but like the setup is so good that you're like, the setup is the first, you know, 2/3 of the episode, so you're fine with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem when you've got like 3 weeks to write an episode. The premise sounds great, and you can sell your episode on the premise, but then you get to like day 10 out of 12 of writing, and you're like, I don't know, where do I go from here?
You know, we can't fault season 3 too much because we got Space Lincoln, right?
We got Space Lincoln.
That's so true.
We got the best starship battle in all of Star Trek. Spock's brain, I'm obliged to say, as Olivia isn't here, is what she wants. It's what she want me to say.
I mean, I will say that from a quidability standpoint, I am always here for camp in Star Trek, but I will say that like the 1960s, just like the aesthetics, like even a bad episode of the original series is still a fun watch, generally speaking. Like, there's some that are bad, but, like, there's a lot of TNG episodes that are just boring or bland, or, like, they're not good, but they're not, like, bad enough that you can hate watch them. I feel like almost everything in season 3 that's quote-unquote bad does have at least, like, Space Lincoln or, like, someone in, like, a sequined bikini that you can look at. So it works out.
Yeah, it doesn't have the minimal, there's no, like, low bar of campness to save you.
Right, and it also is just taking itself, like, every other Star Trek, by definition, is living up to the legacy of, like, Star Trek TM, whereas the original series was just, like, a scrappy, low-budget TV show. So, like, I'm much more willing to forgive it being hokey, because it doesn't feel like it's trying to live up to anything else. Like, that's my main problem with, like, early season TNG, or, like, yeah. Season 1, 2. They're trying so hard to be Star Trek.
It's not hokey or camp enough. And speaking of camp, let's get into Friday's Child, which starts off as camp as possible, with McCoy describing the Capellans, who are 7 feet tall, nomadic people who wear, like, lycra and tights on their head, and like feather dusters around their chests, and apparently are incredibly primitive, but also sign mining treaties with intergalactic powers.
I am so confused about the technological level of this planet, because they're heavily involved in intergalactic trade. Like, this is not their first rodeo, but they haven't invented the bow. So,
and it's not even implied that there's any prime directive shenanigans going on here. No one's like,
right,
oh,
like, what is the prime directive here?
And it's a DC Fontana episode, so it's not as if she didn't know what was going on.
Right.
You know, they didn't invent the bow, but they did have the Kligot, that massive, like, circular saw blade they just chuck at people.
But it's also, they live in, I mean, I can accept, the only exception I have is that maybe they just, the like ruling class of this society, they got into space, but the ruling class just like living in tents.
Well, I also think that, I don't know exactly when, did the Prime Directive go back to the founding of the Federation? Is that like in its founding documents, or did it come later?
It's mentioned in the first, it's in the Starfleet Charter. But also it's kind of mentioned in this episode as well.
Well, I feel like we're sort of, and this happens a lot on the original series specifically, where I think you're supposed to imply that like some people got introduced to aliens before the Federation got there, and because of that, like, their culture is already involved in the intergalactic whatever, so it's actually like doing any additional harm. Like,
yeah, there's no point closing the door. It's the I guess the Prime Director goes from don't interfere to like don't give them nuclear reactors.
Right.
And like, don't try and change how this, or in the case, they don't try and change how these people govern themselves.
Well, they also, at the beginning of the episode, they're talking about, like, both the Klingons and the Federation are trying to make a trade deal because they have some sort of mineral on the planet. And the Klingons, they're very warlike people. And so the Klingons are trying to appeal to their culture and be like, we're warlike too. And the Federation is trying to be like, you know, all those Starfleet ideas, we are, you know, better. It's like the Athens versus Sparta debate that I was meant to have in 10th grade.
I
don't know why they're doing that.
I love
like, they're like, I don't know why they're not actually looking at it from a trade perspective. Like, no one's like, oh, we'll give you more minerals. They're like, our ideals are better, and that's why you should trade with us.
Presumably, it's based on this idea that the Capellans, like, that's how you get to them, and once you get them on the table on ideological stand, you can actually hash out a trade deal. And it's sure, the interesting sure. point is that the Akkar Rickman, because he looks like Alan Rickman, I'll be honest with you. Like, the previous Akkar looks like fucking Alan Rickman.
And Ma'ab looks like Chevy Chase.
Oh, no.
That's true. He does look like Chevy Chase.
Oh, no, he does.
So Space Alan Rickman and Space Chevy Chase. Yeah, we're going to duke it out. Like
the Klingons are talking about how, you know, the Klingon commander is talking about how great he is. And Kirk's like, yeah, the Klingon might be great, but we will just simply leave you alone.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a pretty big offer when, you know, the Klingons is basically governed by decree.
Okay, but here's my thing. And I know that this is, like, not on Kirk per se, and a discussion possibly for another time, but do they leave people alone? Because I feel like they say that, and they're going to leave you more alone than the Klingons, I'll grant you that, but the Federation isn't exactly...
I feel like the bar of where the Federation intervenes is much higher.
That's true.
The Klingon traditional practice is murder the leader of a planet and put a governor in...
Well, that's their culture.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we know how this is going to go. It's going in this direction already, because the moment Kirk beamed down, poor Lieutenant Grant got fucking murked.
Okay, I'm sort of on the Klingon side on this one, or like on the alien people's side. Because he did draw a weapon. Like, if the sight of a Klingon is enough to make you be like, pew pew, if you get shot by said Klingon, like, that's on you.
I mean, we didn't have to hand it to, like, the Capellans, but yeah, Lieutenant Grant kind of fucked up here, and I think we do get a nice bit where Kirk basically chews out McCoy being like, why the fuck didn't you tell me that I was going to lose an officer? And then Kirk eventually, like, it's not really your fault.
I do like the amount of times that the main trio, like, apologize to each other in this episode. There's a lot of, you know, yelling followed 10 minutes later by like, that was wrong of me, here's what I did wrong and I'm sorry, and I'm like, you know what, that's sweet.
episode that was written by DC Fontana.
Yeah, the trio had some good stuff.
They do.
I was gonna say with Grant, so I don't know how I feel about him, you know, getting off to start the episode. You know, at the time the episode was made, right, we didn't have a lot of context about the Klingons and what came before the series, but now that we have Discovery, it's been kind of recontextualized, right? Like, they've already gone through a whole war with the Klingons. Wouldn't that be a natural reaction? Is he really wrong for that after years of war?
Okay, I'm not saying that he's wrong for it, but, like, don't draw a weapon if you're not prepared to be fired upon, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and it's, that's fair. I mean, you've got a point, Ken, because this is also half a season after Errand of Mercy, when there had just been a hot war.
It's true.
But yeah, you're also right.
Well, and also, like, if a Klingon drew a weapon on a Starfleet officer and the Starfleet officer fired upon him because he thought he was about to die, like, I'm going to blame the person who drew the weapon first, in my opinion.
Yeah.
If everything else being equal.
And then, you know, so we have the great bit where this woman comes into the tent that the trio are held in and offers Kirk fruit. And McCoy's like, you see, it's a peace offering. And Kirk's about to take the fruit. And McCoy's like, no. If you eat the fruit, you have to fight her brother. And Kurtz is kind of like, why?
And that's better than sex.
Yeah.
They mention that. They make a point.
Thanks, Gene.
More pleasurable than love, fighting someone in combat.
I love that when he says this, Kirk sort of looks at him like, why didn't you lead with that? Why didn't you lead? with the I'm putting my life on the line here bit. It's...
I mean...
Anyway, so yeah. They have this bit where they try and debate with the Klingon over who gets the Earth rights. And, you know, the Klingons are like, we're going to teach you guns and armored war and, like, space warfare and make you warriors. And Kirk's like, we won't enslave you. These are your options. Welcome to the Cold War. Welcome to the Cold War, folks. It sucks.
Well, and it's kind of crazy because, you know, Akkar actually seems very contemplative and carefully weighs all of the options. And then, like, you've got Ma'ab, who's this, like, economist almost, like, I'm going to get the best deal I can. Screw you. Like, I'm going to go with the Klingons on this, right? And it's a very interesting way to kind of set up this internal strife between them.
Yeah. Then when Kirk's like, we should check if there's a Klingon ship nearby, Akkar goes, this guy does not interest me. And, buddy, it should. Really should. You're playing with the big boys now.
Well, that leads us into the next part of the episode where they do a coup.
There's a coup.
I just wanted to highlight. So part of the best thing about this episode is just all the different like one-liners, and I love when McCoy says, what the Klingon has said is unimportant and we do not hear his words. And he turns around to Jim and goes, I just called him a liar.
Yeah, and like everyone is like, looks at him and like, wow, they that was a laughing. Really smart thing that he says.
Everyone's just like, oh, damn.
Oh.
That was funny.
And Kirk's like, what just happened? It's like when someone, it's like when well, you didn't
they say. Didn't they say at the beginning of the episode that, like, the thing that they hate most in the world is liars?
Yeah.
Whatever the civilization is. So I guess that was supposed to be a callback to that being, like, I insulted them in the worst way possible.
Yeah. It's, I mean, once again, this is a great episode for one-liners. I mean, DC Fontana always writes, like, some of the best lines, you know. She gives, like, McCoy great lines, like, never forget, a teddy bear?
I mean, this is a great McCoy episode. This is like McCoy's time to shine. I mean, the other characters are there, but like, it's McCoy's show.
I mean, yeah. If you want there, there's a bit when the coup starts, when the gang break out of the tent they held in, and Kirk is fighting this guard, and McCoy is supposed to sort of stand there and watch him.
McCoy does a great crossed arm, though. Like, truly no one throws his shoulders back and just like protrudes his tiny little chest like McCoy.
Yeah, so they run to the main camp and the Klingon is just scrabbling on the floor looking for shit. And then him and Kirk fight. And we find out the Klingon's like not got any backup. But then it turns out that Marb has killed Akkar. He's the Tyr now. He would like to kill Kirk. And then Kirk's like, no, why did I fight the Klingon? That'll be fun.
I thought that was a great line.
That
was a well-acted scene, too, because I did like that. One, he had very good timing, and then, like, you do see, like, the look of, I think the actor who was playing the Klingon did a very good job of, like, trying to look brave, but, like, betraying that, like, half second of fear, and then, of course, they do comment on it, and he's like, you know, I saw the fear in your eyes, and now that I know that you feel fear, Klingon, I think that you're a little pussy. So I like you less now.
Tyus Andrews is really good in this. He's the actor who played Crass, which is what the Klingon's name in the script. I don't think his name's ever said on screen, but he's called Crass. And they wanted to have him back for Trouble with Tribbles, but he couldn't get it to line up. But I just wish he'd been back because he's a very good Klingon. And he's not browned up. He's actually just Syrian American.
Well, Klingon not in blackface?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because good for Tio.
Good for Tio. They had one job and they passed it. But yeah, so they're about to fight when the Tio's wife, who is worryingly young and pregnant.
And they mentioned how young she is.
And how old said, he is. Hold on. I had the line here. It was very creepy. Elian, my young wife, to give an old man a son. And I'm like, ooh, no.
I love that you said that, and Kirk just sort of like grimaces a little. He's just like,
Well, Kirk is a feminist, so.
As we know.
As we know, the greatest feminist of the 24th century, James T. Kirk.
God. And I love the bit when the TA's like, the Klingon's a pussy. The Klingon's like, we had a deal. And Marv's just like, no, we didn't.
Also, I think he makes a good point that the deal was that they wouldn't get to keep their weapons. He's like, I want my weapons back. And he's like, I said I'd give you your weapons back once we had a deal. We don't have a deal yet, so go fuck yourself.
Yeah. So the pregnant Tia's wife ex what said, do we ever learn her name?
Eliane. Yeah.
Eliane, yeah. Eliane comes in, she's like, yeah,
my husband's like Friday. Dead.
Yeah. My husband comes in, my husband's dead, so you gotta kill me now. And of course, Kirk, feminist of the year 2268, says, no, don't kill pregnant women. That's bad.
And everyone gets mad at him for it, but everyone that's just the sort of feminist he is.
He's a good ally. He's got hashtags in his username and everything.
I feel like I'm really defending this. What is the name of the planet again?
Capella.
I feel like I'm defending the Capellians a bit too much here. But again, if you're going to have that sort of system, like if you're going to say we are a civilization that like births new chiefs and, you know, the new chief, it's a heretical monarchy situation. If someone is carrying an heir that's not born yet and like someone else just overthrew him, you do need to kill that bitch. Like otherwise that heir is going to come back when they come of age. That's like 101. You got to kill the heir.
Genevieve's been either reading about English history or watching Game of Thrones.
I can do two things.
So actually, no, that's a good point. And I don't know if any of you read the post Nemesis novels, but Leonard James Acar ends up becoming an admiral in Starfleet, and the Capellans like banish him because they fucking hate Starfleet, you know?
Yeah, because he wants to join Starfleet, so they go, "You're never coming back here ever."
And it becomes this really interesting thing where they like, because he joins Starfleet, like they don't let any Starfleet people down on the planet in, you know, the 2400s. It's weird. but that's the whole
good
thing.
It's like
if they had off, I mean, this, right.
The thing is avoided that all that. In the post-DSI novels, it's kind of weird because the role he plays is like, oh, he's Space Colin Powell. He's Space Colin Powell. There's no other way to put it, which is that He's the only sensible person in the room, but he's still like a general. He's still the chief of staff of Starfleet. He's Space Colin. Like, well, I mean, the better example would be.
I mean,
if you've watched The West Wing, he's Space Fitzwallace, but Fitzwallace in The West Wing is just also Colin Powell. So
I was about to say. I mean, I will say that it's not like Star Trek admirals have a great reputation for not being corrupt. So. Much like real life. Nothing against admirals, I guess, but...
Admirals are either corrupt or get on with their jobs so proficiently you don't know who they are, which I think is how I prefer my professional militaries.
That's probably true.
Yeah, so we don't hear about the admirals on Starfleet who are doing sensible, proactive, useful jobs because they're doing sensible jobs and not... kidnapping people or driving starships into asteroids.
A new Star Trek show where nothing bad happens. They just go on little tiny missions and it's always fine.
Strange New Worlds, May 5th, 2022.
The admirals either do really good things and no one hears about them or they just end up dead like Kat Cornwell.
Well, she was war crime lady, so...
Hey, but okay, she really said she
had a war crime a season.
Well, that's true, but also I think she really, because as someone with bad hair, I just feel like I have not been represented in Star Trek. And she proved that you can not care about what your hair looks like and become an admiral in Starfleet. And that's the sort of representation I'm looking for.
You can have terrible hair and commit war crimes against against the Klingon population.
Exactly.
Well, our Klingon in this episode also has terrible hair. I don't know. At one point, he like bends down and you just see of the baldness.
He's a big bald dude.
A bit thinning up there, you know, not the majestic Klingon hair we've seen from some of the others.
But yeah, so while the Kirk is, you know, nearly getting murdered because he tried to not let a pregnant woman get killed, up in orbit, the Enterprise has received a distress call. From the SS Deirdre. And this part of the episode is brought to you by Chekhov's monkey's wig. It's cool, so because they wanted him to have hair like the band The Monkees. It's terrible. It's a disgusting wig.
I mean, because it's very obviously like a wig you would buy for, I don't know what the inflation would be, but like now like $25 at Party City. Like, it's like the standard wig that's on the wall. It is not a professional wig in the slightest.
My favorite was that they wanted Walter Kerr to grow his hair like that, and he just went, I'm not growing my hair out like that.
Well, do you guys remember hearing the story about how there was like an internal letter sent between production people about how all the wigs went missing between seasons?
Yeah.
And like, yes. So, and Shatner apparently had a couple of different wigs. And so, you know, by this point, late season two, I don't think they had money for any real wigs.
Yeah, it's like, I love the best part of that memory is that, yeah, we know that Shatner stole his toupee, but why the fuck does someone have Nichelle Nichols' hairpiece?
I just don't think it would have been that hard to have Walter just grow up. Like, how long does it take a man's hair to grow into a monkey's haircut? He had his normal hair in some of the episodes, and it was fine. It looked just sort of similar, but less like a wig.
Well, the thing is that TOS doesn't come out in production order, so... Like, he has this wig in Who Mourns for Adonis and For Any Child, another episode, but he doesn't have it in A Mock Time.
I just think that they could have, like, let him have short hair for a few episodes and just not given him a wig. I think that would have been okay.
Yeah, probably. But yeah, the Deirdre is under
attack. This is why every Star Trek show should have a teenage girl consultant to, like, yay or nay ideas.
But every Star Trek show also has a terrible wig. And it's glad to see that we're 55 years in, we are continuing the trend of absolutely diabolical wigs with Nilsson. And that genuinely awful wig. It gets worse every episode. People tell me it's getting better. It's not. Sometimes it looks like it's about to fall off her head. I don't know what the actress's natural hair looks like, but just go with it, please.
There's been so many, like, almost every woman that you saw in Star Trek up until Discovery is wearing a wig. They were obsessed with having women have, like, the most, like, Janeway's wigs are insane. They give her so much hair in the first few seasons.
Wasn't there a bit where they were, like, it was Kate Mulgrew's hair, but it was just so ridiculous, they were asking so much of it was absurd?
I think that it was like her real hair around like extensions or something like that. Added to her. Like, yeah. When she had that giant heavy bun.
I thought there was also something with Caretaker where they like filmed it with one hairpiece or something and then they had to go back and change it because it just like did not look good.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, we have to.
Yeah, she went through a variety.
Yeah.
And that one was bad.
And I mean, some of Jolene Bullock's wigs are Chekhov level terrible.
That's true. And like Deanna Troi's always wearing a wig. That's not her real hair. Beverly Crusher's wearing a wig. And like the wigs were usually very close to their natural hair. It was just like fuller. They like were like people in the future are just going to have more luscious hair. And by people, I do mean women.
Did Denise Crosby wear a wig? I don't think she does in season one. But when she appears in All Good Things, she's definitely...
Yeah, when she comes back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, because she has to be Romulan, and that's the only way we know people are Romulans is because of their bad wigs.
And then when she's back for the flashbacks in the series finale, she's in a wig. Is she in a wig in yesterday's Enterprise?
I don't know offhand. I mean, I would assume that if she's in a wig past that point, she's just trying to replicate the hair she had at that time.
Yeah.
Because her hair's too short, guys.
Wasn't her hair like slicked back in yesterday's Enterprise?
Yeah, it's like so up, it's sort of up hair. And it's like a weird pompadour slick back thing.
Yeah.
It is.
It's what a friend of mine referred to as lesbian dream hair.
Friday's child.
So yeah,
I was going to say the next one-liner coming up here is right after the whole fight, McCoy says, "I'm going to go fix your arm. They can only kill me once." the original YOLO in Star Trek.
It's a very good line. And then basically they're like to her, "Yeah, we know you think you're going to die for ritual, but would you prefer to live?" And she sort of looks at him and goes, "Yeah, I think I would." So they fuck off out of there with their communicators to Southern California, which...
It has one of my favorite tropes of TOS, where the trio looks at each other and says something very, very obviously, like, laced with some sort of other meaning, and they act like it's so sneaky. They're like, "Yes, that is an excellent idea." My favorite version is still in Wrath of Khan, though, where, like, Spock heavily emphasizes hours could turn to days, and then very specifically says, "It'll take 3 days." Incredibly obvious.
My favorite is in Brenda Circus's, when they're in a prison and they're figuring out how to escape, and the Decius, the guy with them's like, "You guys seem to have been in prison a lot." And they all sort of look at each other like, "Yeah." So yeah, they're escaping to Southern California, and it turns out this woman doesn't like her baby, which that's not great. So while Spock and Kirk scout, McCoy's trying to look after her arm and the baby, and she's not very happy about him touching her. So he tries to check on the baby, so she slaps him. And then she slaps him again, and then McCoy slaps a pregnant woman.
This is the most cursed part of the episode.
Yeah.
It's bad. It's pretty.
I always remember the McCoy slapping, and I never remember that he slapped twice beforehand.
And not even the dialogue. Like, he says, "Listen to me, young woman. Hold on." Condescending as fuck, right? And then, "I'll touch you in any matter my professional judgment indicates." And I'm like, ooh, that's creepy.
That line, dude.
Ooh.
Okay, McCoy, but no. McCoy did turn both cheeks before he turned to her. So, you know, he was out of turning.
Out of cheeks you could show on primetime television in 1967.
Exactly. I mean, I didn't love the line because, okay, he sort of waffles with it because in half of the episode, he's like, "You can't tell me what to do. Like, I don't care. If you don't want my help, you're going to get it." And then the other half, he's like, "I'll only help you if you say you want it." And like, is like yelling. He's like, "I can't do anything until you say you want it." And like, I don't know. It's like he weirdly flip flops on it. And he like makes a point about it each time.
Isn't the second bit, though, is that he's not that he wants help, is that he wants her to admit she wants the baby?
It's both. He also is like, "I want you to like want to live. Too. Gender politics of this episode are not ideal."
Right.
What are the gender politics of Star Trek ideal? Moving on. So,
but it's interesting because this, like, everything he says is rooted in his like oath to medicine, and it's like, so it's not coming from a bad place, but just the way he tries to convince her is terrible. Like, it's no.
Well, and also not to be that person, but like, I do think it was a different time. So like, I think like specifically the way that he phrased it, we find more like, not necessarily like the content of it, but like the specific words that he's using are like, I think way more loaded now than they would have been.
Yeah, I think the phrase he says, like, you know, I could use better, but it's pretty grim to us, but I think a doctor now would basically say the same thing, but in his own, but in a much less grim way.
Right. It's like, it's my job to save your life. And so I have to do that or else you will die. And I don't want that on my conscience kind of thing. And it's like,
doesn't make it better.
I know it doesn't. It doesn't. The only thing that kind of makes this better is right afterwards. You kind of can forget because of Spock and the whole the soft hands discourse that happens.
Yeah, the soft
right
hands discourse.
The soft hands. And then the look from Spock is so funny. It made me forget for half a second how awful McCoy just was. And then I remembered again afterwards, but yeah.
I mean, here's my question is why is it so important that she wants the baby? Like from a medical standpoint, which is his whole thing, this whole episode, like, I don't know how to tell you this, whether you want the baby or not, you're going into labor. So
is it so that she doesn't kill it once it's born?
I think that's what it is.
Correct me if I'm wrong, it's not that hard to overpower a woman who literally just gave birth and like just keep her away from the baby. I think that wouldn't be that difficult. I just don't know if you need to be yelling at her like mid like push, you know, being like, you have to like have this conversation. You have to have this like philosophical mind flip now. You know, and not like when you're holding the baby. I'm going to do it while you're in intense pain because of this child.
It doesn't seem important either to the plot or to the delivery of the baby.
Well, actually, I think I feel like maybe the only reason he's trying to get her to keep it is actually for the diplomatic side of things. Because like the beginning of the episode, he was really diplomatic and trying to ease the tensions. And it's, well, if we have this baby who's supposed to be the heir, like, all right, if we keep them, we can smooth things over because my ob's going down right after this.
I mean, that's not really.
I feel like it's also he's coming at it from like, he's like, in my professional doctor like code, I have to like protect life.
But yeah.
And like, babies are the most life things. They're brand new, they need help. The B plot of this episode, there's a B plot, a C plot. The C plot is the Enterprise running off to go on a distress signal, which we later find out is fake. It was a trap. And then the other plot is that Kirk and McCoy, or Kirk and Spock, are just like making fun little doohickeys out of the rocks and sticks they find.
Yeah, it's like, so Spock sees McCoy being the alien just being like, ooh, you have soft hands. And Spock sort of goes, all right, fine.
I'm not getting into this, but. So
he goes to Kirk, and Kirk's like, could we use our communicators to bring the cliff face down? And Spock's like, it might not work. And Kirk's like, oh, well, I guess if we have nothing else, I guess if it won't work, then we won't try it.
And then, you know, he pouts, and then Spock's like, okay.
So they do it, and they blow up this rock wall, which turns out to be made of styrofoam.
Hold on. Before they blow up the wall, though, so they position at the top of that rock, and then in the whole frame, it's like you see the rock, you see the Capellans, and then just ass. I was like, this is a curious shot here. Okay.
Like in the editing suite, they're just like, why is there a whole second of ass? And the guy just goes, no reason. we had to fill a gap in it. And Bill stood in front of the camera for like 3 minutes. It was fine.
But they do blow it up. They do cause an avalanche.
A styrofoam.
And then after that, they invent the bow, which apparently nobody on this planet ever considered.
But also, the Klingon stole a phaser off a dead Capellan and is now following the Capellans. It's really funny because they quite obviously chose really tall people for the Capellans. And Tyg Andrees is not very tall. So it's just these people striding up a hill where Tyg Andrees just sort of runs up behind them, really.
Well, McCoy said they were 7 feet tall.
God. So yeah, so they go and hide in a Pape. Oh no, so they're going up this hill, Kirk's found a cave, and they're trying to get Aline up a hill, and she's like, no, only McCoy can touch me. And McCoy's like, come on guys, I'm a doctor, not an escalator, which.
Classic.
Classic.
The classic, mm-hmm. I'm not a doctor line. Yeah, I am a doctor line, not a.
I think that's our first I'm a doctor line of the podcast. because they don't happen in bad episodes.
Yeah.
It's the only one I remember. So, yeah. So
there's a bricklayer. I forgot what episode it's in.
That's in Devil in the Dark.
Bricklayer? Is that Devil in the Dark, right, or is that?
No, it's Devil in the Dark. It's Empath. No.
There's one in Empath, I think.
There is one in Empath.
Anyway.
So, yeah, on the Enterprise, they've gone out to where the Deirdre was and stuff in there, and Scotty's like, I don't like this at all. So, and they're in the paper mache cave, which embarrassing, really. And then basically Kirk's like to McCoy, why is he cooperating? You give her a happy pill?
Yeah, that's another
McCoy's reply dated, right cross.
Dated terrible line. Yeah.
Did you put her on methamphetamine? Did you put her on morphine? No, I punched her. And Kirk's just like, oh. He just like, what the fuck?
Feminist ally Kirk strikes again.
Yeah. And so yeah, then the baby, you know, they go about their Boy Scout stuff, making bows and arrows, and then the baby's born, and McCoy had spot the baby, and he looked so uncomfortable.
Well, while they're making the bows, I just wanted to highlight this one interaction, another great one-liner between Spock, or actually it's an interchange between Spock and Kirk. They're talking about their bows, like little five-year-olds making bows out of sticks, right? And Spock goes, oh, this the wood here has suitable tensile cohesion. And then he's just like, yeah, it makes a good bow. And then he's like, I said that. I just said that. Thank you.
It is like 5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then I also love how, I mean, it's obviously a fake baby that they're handing each other, but it's like very stiff. And he's like, no, you can't put your hand there. You got to support the head. And it's like obviously just a block of wood wrapped in a blanket.
I do not want this.
And then the Elliot is like, bring our baby, McCoy. And Kirk and Spock are like, what did we miss? And the first time I watched this, I thought that it was like, oh, McCoy fathered this child when he was on the planet.
Oh, no.
I was like 14 and I wasn't paying attention. I'm like, wait, sure. McCoy? Is this McCoy's love child?
The whole reason for that is because it's like a linguistic misunderstanding, because they do the Star Trek thing where the population speaks English, but like it's a broken English, so you know that they're foreign. And he's like, you gotta say that this baby is mine, not like, you know, whatever her husband was. And she's like, the baby is McCoy's. And he's like, no, it's mine. You have to say it. McCoy. She's like, it's yours. And
yeah, she even says his name weird.
That's like, the whole reason, yeah. Well, that's how you know she's four.
I wonder in-universe if it's because... So they were able to get the communicators back for Kirk and Spock, but I don't think McCoy got his communicator back. So I wonder if that's what's going on, if it's like a weird translator thing that's not working. I don't know. Maybe. Either way, it's hilarious.
Anyway, so back on the ship, they're like, this is a trap, isn't it? And Scotty's like, yeah, we're gonna have to go back. And they get another fake distress signal, and Sulu's like, what if it's real? And Scotty, you know, goes, there's an old Earth saying, fool me once, shame on me, you, me. Fool me twice, shame on you. And then
I'll go around, goes, but I know what you meant.
Yeah, I'll say it again. He says, Scotty goes, there's an old Earth saying, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you. Is it the other way around?
It is the other way around.
Dang it. Well, either way, phrase, Chekhov then goes twice. On to... Anyway,
he says, I know that phrase. It was invented in Russia, and everyone does a look at him. And I love this bit, because you can see Chekhov smiling like a dick.
That's 80% of Chekhov's lines in TOS, is just saying, it is Russian.
And he's just like... And then just Scotty's like, I have no time for this.
Okay, here's my question. What if that distress call was real?
Well, then probably there probably is going to be some form of inquiry then.
Yeah.
Also, just a quick note, Ahura's nails in this episode, incredible. She has that silver nail polish.
Uhura, I'm a big fan. Everyone is great in this episode, actually.
Yeah. I love when Montgomery Scott is in command. He has, I love his little accent. I love his demeanor. He's got uncle energy, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's the way he walks. He always walks his hands slightly behind his back. I'm like, oh, that's funny. Mm-hmm. He realizes it's because he doesn't want to have his missing finger on screen. It's like, oh. Only Matt, he had hand doubles. I just think about that.
I just feel like they could have been like, as an engineer, he lost a finger. And it would have been fine.
I feel like Gene would have said something weird, like he got a replacement body part. So, yeah, so they go back. And in the meantime, Aline has clobbered Bones with a stone and run away. So, sure. the Enterprise is en route, and then a clone warship moves across in front of them. And we get this great bit where just before the end of Act 3 and the ad break, Scotty calls battle stations. And we get 15 seconds of just a shot behind sort of Sulu's targeting scanner coming out from the console and moving into position. There's no like change of camera, it's just a solid shot of this thing, this motorized scanner moving up. And it's like, even for me, I'm like, come on.
I feel like TOS has sometimes those moments where you're just like, oh, they had to pad the runtime or something. Yeah. Although this episode's a full 50 minutes. And I feel like some of them were closer to like 45, but
yeah,
sometimes they just had the B-roll.
This one feels like they did it for dramatic effect, because you know, Scotty goes like sound battleship stations, they swing the camera around behind Sulu, and then the scanner just is, I think it's, they had the scanner installed on the console and they wanted to show that it can go up and down.
Sure.
Right.
Because it was motorized. It wasn't like a puppet. They put a motor into the actual set.
Oh, so I mean, that is impressive.
Because it would pop the, there's a motor that would pop the little shutters open and then it would come up like that. It was motorized. So presumably they were like, we have to show that everyone we can do this. And
it was very impressive at the time.
I'm sure if I was 8 years old in 1968, I'd be very impressed, but I'm not.
I'll give it a pass.
So... yeah, so the Clover Warship's like, we're not going anywhere. And Scotty's like, we'll see about that.
Oh, he's pissed. I think because he's already like made a mistake, he's like upset at himself. And then he's just like, we're just going to shove this right down their throats. Like, I am done.
Let's see if they have the belly for it.
Right.
I think that's right. Scotty's sort of always vibe while he's in command. And I'm always here for it.
You see, I'm
very defensive.
I'm the stronger thing that Scotty came up from the ranks. Like, he didn't go to Starfleet Academy. He was
definitely, I would agree.
A crewman. And
he's like the O'Brien route, yeah.
Yeah, and unlike O'Brien, he took the promotion to become an officer. Because it's the only way you get the fact that he's just complete no bullshit man.
Right.
But yeah, so it turns out the Capellas have arrived at their hideout, and the Klingon is literally like hands on knees panting. He's just exhausted. So then the wife comes and is like, yeah, I killed them and the baby. And the Capella's like, yeah, that's good enough for us. Let's go. And the Klingon's like, no.
They don't lie.
Yeah, they don't lie. So the Klingons are like
Vulcans.
They're like Vulcans, but Camper?
Sure.
So the Klingon's like, no, fuck you. We're going to go check. And he pulls out a phaser and starts running up the hill. At which point Kirk shoots him in the knee with an arrow.
Classic. As you do. I actually laughed out loud when he got hit in the knee. I was like, okay.
It's a very camp man who's been shot by an arrow. And, you know, we get a fight scene and Spock, and he gets blown up. And Kirk's like, I just want to kill the Klingon. And Spock's like, revenge? And Kirk, really out of character, just goes, why not? It's really weird just to go like, yeah, that's a very bloodthirsty line.
Yeah. One of us has to get him.
Cool. Yeah, this Klingon's kind of got a bit nuts. So then Marv is basically, right, I'm going to kill myself now.
I give you back your life. Klingon! I just like, he's just like full spread. It's like
playing a dumping jack.
Yeah.
It's a really weird seat.
Okay, can I ask a question? And I don't know if this it needs to have one, but I feel like generally speaking, episodes of Star Trek have a point. And I'm not saying that this wasn't an enjoyable time, that there weren't one-liners in it, but like, does this have a like philosophical point that it's trying to make?
Don't fall for military ruses.
I guess, yeah. But like, there's a lot of fighting in it.
Well, I think this is the thing. DC Fontana episodes don't tend to have a message to. Like, what's
the message? Cowboy diplomacy, maybe?
Yeah, but like, what's the message behind Journey to Babel? Don't be a deadbeat dad?
Yes.
Yes.
I guess this is love your children.
Well, it tells us something. It like tells us a lot about Spock's background. I think that's the point.
Yeah.
Is it adds a richness to Spock's character.
Whereas what does this add? I guess it tells us what this universe is like.
Right.
I'm not saying I didn't enjoy watching it. No, I just feel like, generally speaking, especially TOS episodes have a like, especially when they have like there's more introspective episodes that happen on the ship mostly, but I feel like usually if they're like going down and meeting with a culture, and like there are so many points where like it has all the trappings of an episode that's trying to make a point, like the fact that like they have this like, you know, back and forth of the Klingons, the fact that like the culture is so different than ours, and like I don't know, I just feel like it's trying to make a point, but I have absolutely no idea what that would be.
I don't think it's making a, I think there's no point to it.
I think there's a very weak point, and the weak point is that the Federation will do what needs to be done to protect its citizens, and that's try to make this deal for the Topoline so that they can have life support. Like, that's what it was for, it was life support, but that's still, like, said it as a one line at the beginning of the episode, and then you don't really see it again.
It's just kind of a fun romp.
Do they make a deal at the end of the...
Yeah, the mining agreement is signed by the Regent, which is Aleen.
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah, because what happens now is, so Marb is dead, the Klingon is dead, everyone just sort of walks down the hill to the dead bodies, and Kirk and Spock are prepared for a fight, and the Capellans are to kill them, and Scotty just appears with a troop of red shirts and just yells, "Drop your weapons," which is nice. It's always nice when Scotty gets to leave the ship.
I do like how the Klingon died by the weapon that the Capellans use, which again is called a Kligot. And so the Klingon died by a Kligot. Just, I don't know. I appreciate wordsmithing sometimes. And just, he got Kligotted. It's fine. Like, yeah. Does that work?
Klingon got Kligotted.
A Klingon craft got Kligotted.
There you go. Nice.
So it's a great bit because Scotty comes down and Kirk's like, "Ah, you're back." And Scotty's like, "Yeah, we had some trouble with the Klingons, but they came to the stomach for a fight." And then McCoy appears with a baby and Scotty just turns around and is like, "What the fuck did I miss?" He's just like, I was gone for 2 days and I'm a baby now.
They name the baby after not just McCoy, but also Kirk. Because it's Leonard James Akbar or whatever his was. Akbar.
And that's a great bit because they're on the bridge and folks like, the child was named Leonard James Akbar. And McCoy goes, "I think it's a really good name, James." And then Kirk goes, "Yes, I think it's a wonderful name, Leonard." So, and then they go, "Well, he's six, Spock." And Spock goes, "I think you're both going to be insufferable for at least a month, sir."
Well, when
another
when
great one-liner.
Right, when Kirk says, he's like, "Oh, those names, you know, destined to go down in galactic history." It's like classic Kirk stroking his own ego. And then Spock is like, "Yeah, yeah,
I got to get to this shit." I still almost...
Speaking of good one-liners,
at the end,
the sir is good.
Insufferable sir. Period.
We missed a really key one-liner, which is when McCoy is like baby talking to the child, and Spock just goes "hoochie coochie coo,"
and Kirk goes, "Look it up with the language department."
It's a unique dialect from Earth.
And Scotty's just like, I don't know what's going on anymore. Did we just even sort of like, what? Poor Scotty. Never knows what's going on.
So I watch all my episodes with subtitles on, and just to see Oochie Woochie Coochie Coo spelled out.
Yeah, that screenshot.
I lost
it's
it.
So good. It's my favorite screenshot of this episode. But yeah, so trivia wise, the lean to get around my microphone thing. So this was filmed at the Vasquez Rocks.
Yep.
In late May, with temperatures of up to 110 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oof.
Which is like, what's that in Celsius? Like 30, 40?
That sounds about right. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, I feel like for how hot it apparently was, I feel like there's episodes where they've looked sweatier. Like there's some sweaty episodes of TOS, and this is not high on that list.
Well, I think the people who suffered most were apparently the actors playing the Capellans who were wearing all black.
Oh, yeah.
And like fur and stuff and like head stuff. So if they were sweaty, we didn't see because they were extras. But Tyg Andrews, who played Crass in all the Klingon games, had a lot of fun. Like apparently he really enjoyed dressing up as a Klingon. It was better than most of the like costume for the film. If you want a really bad line, Memory Alpha includes the incredibly cursed line, Tyg Andrews' exotic demeanor helped him get into the character of Crass.
Okay.
Which is apparently a quote from a Star Trek VHS intro to the episode.
Which cool.
Great.
No.
In DC Fontana's original script, Aline sacrificed her child for her own life.
Ooh, that is interesting.
Gene objected to this and changed the ending to what appears in the finished episode. Fontana also envisioned Aline as a strong woman who rebels against a society which considers women only as mothers and homemakers. Oh, so there was a point. Gene just got rid of it.
Okay, because I was going to bring this up, which is that, like, similar to the fact that, like, McCoy sort of, like, wavers back and forth between being, like, I'm going to help you no matter what you say, and being, like, you have to, like, you know, want this as much as I do or whatever. Like, I feel like there started to be a point when they first, like, break away and are out with the pregnant lady, and Kirk talks about how she, like, hates her baby. And, like, you think that there's going to be some message about, like, reproductive rights and the fact that, like, she didn't want this kid and she, like, doesn't want it now, and, like, this kid is the reason that she has to die. And, like, I was like, that's, like, a bold stance to be taking in 1968, this would be. But I was like, that, and, like, it's something that Star Trek had, like, touched on a bit more obliquely, obviously, in some other episodes. I don't know if they came, I think they came before this, or maybe after. That, like, does the classic Star Trek of talking about an issue without talking about an issue. But, I thought, like, you know, to very directly be like, not every woman wants her child, like, even if she's, like, obviously at this point literally going into labor, like, and then, like, all of a sudden at the very end it, like, reverses, and, like, McCoy makes this, like, very, like, distinguished plea that's, like, you have to want this baby. Like, it grew in you. You have to want it, like, regardless of anything else. Like, and it's, like, he's trying to get her to accept that she's, like, her own person who, like, is allowed to want things and she's not the property of her husband, while also being like, but you are bound to this child and you do have to want it.
Yeah, and it's that sort of, I mean, it's a moral quandary. You know, you just want the child, she has a child, it's hers. I guess it's the best way you could look at it. That it is her child, not a man's child.
Yes, but also the, like, she isn't, like, you're gonna go with DC Fontana's original ending.
Yeah,
I'm assuming that's the reason I think honestly, if you kept the McCoy part in where he's like saying you need to care for the child and then she still does it, I think it makes the point stronger. If you're making the argument that, like, the reason that she has to die is because she's birthing this, like, guy's kid, and as long as that guy's kid's alive, her life is in danger. Like, I could see the argument. Like, obviously, I'm not pro baby killing it. I want to make that for the record. I'm not pro killing innocent children. However, I think that, like, you know, in the nature of Star Trek, of characters that make, like, bad, messy choices, I think that'd be a very interesting bad, messy choice.
It would be an interesting
I know
choice.
Why they didn't do it.
It's a pretty, it's not a choice you could get away with on television in 1968, I think.
It's not a choice I think you could get away with now, to be quite honest.
Yeah. So if you want, so not only were the Capellan warriors wearing all black in sweltering May weather, they were also in platform shoes.
Good for them.
Poor climbing rocks, those poor bastards.
I imagine after all the boulders fell on them, all the styrofoam boulders, they couldn't get back up because the platform shoes probably got in the way. Once you're down,
I will
you're
say down. It seems very clear that they're only using like a 30-foot square area to film everything. Like they just keep going up and down that little hill over
yeah,
and over
like
again.
The same
different
hill,
scenes.
They just like rotated. Oh,
yeah,
the
problem
angle.
With
yeah, just from a different angle.
There's a big, like, at the center of it, there's a big, like, green area. And there's also, like, a big, like, you know, the fort in the at the beginning of Arena, the star base that got an outpost?
Yep.
I guess that's in the middle of Vasquez Rocks. So. You have to kind of get around that.
That's true, I suppose.
That's fair.
There's not actually a lot of filming space there. But, yeah, so the title, Friday's Child, comes from a rhyme in Harper's Weekly in 1887, which goes, Monday's child is fair of face. Tuesday's child is full of grace. Wednesday's child is loving and giving. Thursday's child works hard for a living. Friday's child is full of woe. But the child is born on the Sabbath day is brave and bonny and good and gay.
Yeah, fuck people born on Fridays.
Yeah. So I guess that's why it was Friday's Child, because Friday's Child is full of woe.
I think the title also works better with DC Fontana's original ending.
Yeah.
Once again, it's just really grim.
I mean, to be clear, that ending is dark. Like, that's a dark way to end a Star Trek episode, and I completely get why they didn't do it. But you're right, that does make it have a point that without that, it doesn't really have. Because otherwise, like, why are we introducing this as, like, a concept of, like, the fact that she's owned by a man, and she's, like, she doesn't want to be, like, there's no reason to have her give her that arc if she's just gonna, like, be fine.
Yeah. So
again, not that I needed to see them kill a baby.
Yeah, that's not.
But it's a stronger narrative.
It's a stronger narrative, which is at the same thing in time. But with that considered, are we quitting, folks?
Well, actually, there's one more interesting trivia piece here.
Oh.
This is the first episode where all seven classic crew members appear in the same scene, and it's at the beginning, I think, right?
Isn't it a cheat? Because Sulu appears on the screen.
Yeah, I think that's what they said. It's like technically whatever, but yeah. So I think that's a cool thing to throw in there.
Yeah, because the thing I think for most of season two, Walter, what's his name, George Takei is like on Mission Impossible, so he's not really around.
Right.
He's not. He's doing other things. It's like Nichelle Nichols doesn't do it for a bit because she's doing theater. There's some yeah. Anyway. Quitting, yes or no?
I'm not going to quit this, and I'm going to give, on a trip nip scale, I'm going to give it maybe a 3, but I think if they had gone with the original ending, it would have been a full 5.
If they go with the original ending, it would be like a 6 or a 7, but they didn't, so it gets like a 3 or a 4 for the slapping.
Yeah, one nip for each slap. I'll give this
I'm
episode.
That's what I was thinking.
I'm giving it one for each slap and then an extra one for threatening to stab a pregnant woman on television.
I am not quitting. I think I will also give it a 4. One for each slap and one for the happy pills. Because that
was the happy pills.
Awful.
So, hold on. So you gave it... I have a spreadsheet so I can work out... average triplets. So Genevieve gave it 3, I gave it 4, you gave it 4 as well. 4.
So it's like a 3.6.
3.6-ish.
Nice.
Which, worse than the Changeling, but better than the Cage.
That's the spirit.
That's the spirit. So, yeah. That wasn't too bad. That was quite fun. I enjoy Friday's Child. I think it's a good episode.
I think it's an underrated episode. I get why some people might not like it, but I don't know. It's a fun one to blow an hour on.
It raises strong questions about the ethics of extracting mineral wealth from a people who don't appear to have even got electricity.
True.
I mean, case in point, it does not raise those issues.
Exactly. It's like, I would have loved the discussion of how exactly the Capellans, who appear to be a semi-nomadic people, are in contact with space powers enough for them to sign treaties.
Have not invented bow and arrow.
Right. So they're in the books, they're mining equipment. All the Topolines like in the caves. And so they've got like mining equipment set up in the caves, but I think someone else brings the mining equipment to them. I don't think it's theirs.
I feel like the Capellans make sense if like during the early 23rd century, someone had just gone and they'd just been traded with before, there'd been proper enforcement of the Prime Directive. And it's kind of, as you said at the beginning, Genevieve, like, what can you do?
Well, I also think that DC Fontana wanted to tell a story, and much like a lot of TOS episodes, they decided they didn't really give a fuck. So,
as they should, more Star Trek writers to just do that. Oh, how are we going to make this work in the canon? You write it and figure it out afterwards.
If the ship doesn't make aerodynamic sense, I'm not watching.
It's a
vacuum of space. This vacuum of space. That.
I just want it to look pretty. Anyway.
That's why I sign everything up upside down. All my blueprints, turn them around.
Turn them upside down. You see that engineering section on the top.
On the top.
On the top. So while Genevieve messes with the laws of God and man, do you have anything to plug to the listeners, Caleb?
At the moment, no, but you can find me on Twitter at Rogue Moog, R-O-G-U-E-M-O-G-H.
Excellent. And you can find us at Quit Star Trek Pod on Twitter, or email us at iquitstartrek@gmail.com. If you send me emails asking where Olivia is, she stays away for an extra week. That's the threat. You know, and the longer this goes on, you know, if you keep asking, I will just make Rick Berman the host of the podcast, and then no one will be happy.
I'm gonna call your bluff, though, Jack.
Call my bluff and ask me.
I'm gonna call your bluff because the longer Olivia stays away, the more money you have to pay Genevieve.
Oh, so true, King.
I'll get another host. He's less expensive.
I mean, you just have to have only non-male guests.
I could do that. I could do
making that. Change one podcast at a time.
I could do
one extortion at a time.
I mean, listen, this is already a podcast with a higher number of people calling it than 90% of Star Trek podcasts. Give us that. I'm here. I bumped the diversity up by like 80%.
That's true.
I'm black, gay, and foreign.
I don't know if I'd give a British person points for diversity.
I think, well, Americans would.
For being British.
I'm British.
It's like saying Malcolm makes it more diverse.
Well, I'm British and black, which Americans don't believe is a real thing. So it's a double bonus.
My dad is a high school librarian, and he tried to stock things about black Canadians under like their own separate section. And they're like, that goes under African American. And he's like, they're not American. And they're like, but they're black. He's like, yeah, that's why I put it under there.
Anyway, that's it for this week from America's most diverse black British podcast. Until next time, don't slap a pregnant woman. Bye, everyone.
Unless she deserves it.
Unless she
deserves it. I mean, bye, she's everyone. Being hysterical.
Bye, everyone.